you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. This week, our critics review Renee Zellweger's turn as Judy Garland in the biopic Judy. Zellweger's performance, critically acclaimed at festivals. We'll hear what our critics think. Also, Abominable, a new animated feature this week, and The Laundromat, starring Meryl Streep and Gary Oldman. Those and many more films on this week's Film Week.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. We have a number of very interesting and promising films. We'll see if the promise is fulfilled. Joining me this week are critics Amy Nicholson, who writes on film for The Guardian and hosts the podcast Unspooled and the podcast miniseries Zoom. Tim Cogshell, Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com film critic. And Charles Solomon, who writes for Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. We begin with Judy, a biopic which is based on the stage play End of the Rainbow, which was a hit here at the Amundsen Theater in Los Angeles. In the film adaptation, Renee Zellweger stars as a late in life and career Judy Garland who's gone to London essentially for a paycheck for a series of performances. In this scene from Judy, she's alongside co-star Jesse Buckley, who plays her manager.
What's the matter?
Ladies and gentlemen.
I can't. What? What do you mean you can't? There's an audience out there waiting to hear you sing.
My mouth dry and it could fall apart.
Listen to me.
Judy!
I can't. You'll be fine. Now, on you go.
Rupert Gould is the director. Tom Edge adapted the play for the screen. Amy, what'd you think of Judy?
Yeah, I mean, this movie follows a lot of standard biography tics. You know, like, here it is. She's tense. She's nervous. You know, it's a film that is just designed around one thing specifically, which is showcasing Renee Zellweger's incredible performance as Judy Garland at really on her last nerve as a performer. You know, as you can hear in that clip, she is jet lagged. She's insecure. She is done with kind of doing what people have told her to do. You know, you have these flashbacks here of Louis B. Mayer telling her she's fat, of Louis B. Mayer ordering her around that are meant to give kind of a psychological heft, which anybody who knows Judy Garland as a performer doesn't really need. We know this about her background. We know what brought her to this place. And so the film just really focuses on her when she has so little left in herself that and she's just giving whatever she can to the audience and hoarding what she needs. You know, it's a really complicated, messy Judy Garland that's on screen that you can't help but love. I mean, to me, this film is just watching Renee go. She does her own singing here, and she's not trying to sound exactly like Judy Garland. She's just communicating this kind of vulnerability and fragility in her voice that's so affecting. You know, I think as bad as sometimes the film sort of is in an eye-rolling way, it almost just makes Renee look better because she still makes it carry through.
Tracy Bennett did a powerhouse performance on stage in the lead role in Los Angeles. It's tough to compete with that. Sounds like Zellweger does that effectively. Tim, what do you think of Judy?
I thought it was quite good, particularly her. She inhabits the space rather than the actual form of Judy Garland here. It's like a glancing sort of performance. She's Judy Garland-esque. in all things, but not trying to live right on top of it, which I think is really her unsteadiness. That, you know how Judy would, she'd be out there and you'd feel like she's going to fall over.
Yeah, even on her CBS TV show, when you watch the old clips, it looks like she's ready to have a nervous breakdown in the show.
In dead center stage.
And of course, all of that emotion came out in those performances. When Judy would perform, and that was the thing about her, the voice, yes, absolutely, but it was actually the performance itself that was the thing. She gave it all. This movie, interesting, a few of these lately, right? You got Freddie Mercury and Elton John not long ago. A couple of years ago, John Cusack, Love and Mercy. Mm-hmm. All very, very good.
This
harkens back to Diana Ross in Lady Sings the Blues. That's the that same fragility, that life around her. And I didn't really mind those little flashbacks to her roaming around the set of Wizard of Oz with Louis B. Mayer lurking over her and those little dowagers slipping her pills all the time. Every now and again, going back to that just reminded me they did this to this girl. Because otherwise, you would blame her for who she is. But you can't blame Judy for Judy. Her mother, she was sold out. She was ratted out from the time she was a child. And I think that's what this movie speaks to.
That's true.
It's not your fault, Judy.
You're right, because you see all the people in London blaming her because she's making everybody's life miserable. But, right, we are always on her side. Even when we're so mad at her, she falls in love again in this movie, her last husband. And you want to, like, grab the screen and say, don't do it. He's too young. He has nothing to offer you. But Renee Zellweger, in her scenes with him, looks at him with such devotion. It just breaks your heart. But really, I think the strongest thing here is many times Rupert Gold just stops and lets us watch Renee sing. You have several song performances here in full. One of them that I think is essentially unbroken. He just holds the camera, walks around her, watches her sing. And it's absolutely magnetic.
It's very good, too, because otherwise this would live in that space of a stage play. You know, originally a stage play. But because that camera moves around and very often ends up right in this gigantic close-up of her face, and then she'll turn to that profile. It's just really, really wonderfully done.
And Zellweger, it sounds like, doesn't indulge some of the mannerisms that she brings to her roles of the past.
Yeah, I mean, this Judy is a very twitchy Judy, and it's a very twitchy
but Judy.
Renee.
But Garland.
Judy,
but Garland.
So she's
Garland's
doing the twitchy.
Mannerisms,
yeah.
Not Zellweger.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, none of the pinchy faces.
So at you think that... as of now, she's the front runner for the Best Actress Oscar?
She's going to get a nomination, that's for sure.
I do. Because it is sort of that trifecta of just like actors making a comeback. We haven't seen Renee do a lead performance like this in so long as an icon, and also giving it her all and also singing. Like, it's everything you want to see.
And suffering.
So I think this one's going to be very hard to beat.
Judy is the film. It's in wide release, rated PG-13. And John Horn of The Frame interviewed Renee Zellweger at the Telluride Film Festival where the movie premiered. And you can listen to it by linking to our Film Week page, kpcc.org. The Yeti-themed animated feature Abominable is DreamWorks' latest movie. Jill Coulton, the writer-director. It's her second animated feature after Open Season, more than a decade ago. Abominable, about a young girl who meets a lost Yeti and agrees to help him find his way home.
There's a Yeti on my roof. Hey, boy.
Or girl.
Whoa!
Yeah, you're definitely a boy.
Abominable. Charles?
Well, this is about our fifth animated Yeti movie in the last couple years, and while it's not horrible the way some of the recent animated features have been, it's very stale, very familiar, and you've seen it all before. The spunky girl meets the Yeti who's escaped from her research facility, and with her two friends, one of whom looks like Hiro's older brother from Big Hero 6, who's been shrunk a bit, and his chubby cousin, who is Russell from Up, they have to take him back on this long travel log to the Himalayas. And it's basically Up with some bits of Lilo and Stitch and How to Train Your Dragon and The Good Dinosaur. Even Ice Age is taking the kid back to his family kinds of things. They're opposed by an industrialist named Burnish, who needs the Yeti to prove something because he's been laughed at before without physical proof, who is, of course, Charles Muntz from Up. Everything is familiar. There are some beautiful effects. Particularly these cloud goldfish that go with a Chinese legend that if a certain point a carp attains the top of the waterfall, it will turn into a dragon. So they're very beautiful. There's some gorgeous backgrounds. But the last third of the movie, I was giving the characters lines before they were, because we've been in that situation before. We've heard them say these things, and here it comes again.
Amy, what do you think of Abominable?
Yeah, I mean, what I thought was funny about the explorer character that Sir Edmund that Eddie Izzard plays is that it's based on Sir Edmund Hillary, who, you know, when he climbed up to Everest, said that he saw Yeti footprints and was mocked for a very long time, and went back 7 years later to try to prove that it was true. And
I hadn't heard that story.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Sir Edmund Hillary thought he saw a Yeti. So I enjoyed that bit of it, and this idea of a man who, you know, he's so sensitive. He's going to move heaven and earth just to keep people from laughing at him. I enjoyed that. But yeah, the Yeti here is basically Toothless from How to Train Your Dragon with Fur. He moves the same way. He has kind of the same jokes and reaction shots. I didn't dislike this movie. I liked a lot of the travelogue part of it. You see the seams of them trying to make a film that appeals to everybody. There's a moment where they go to this giant Buddha, this beautiful historical landmark site in Asia, and the lead girl starts to play Coldplay on violin. And it's this, like, East meets West meets pandering meets beautiful combination. I started to miss up. I missed it a little bit, and I was a little bit mad at myself for missing. I mean, the whole thing. That's how it is.
The Yeti is magical. You're already a Yeti. But we're going to have a magical Yeti?
You don't
Yeti?
Need superpowered Yeti?
This is just taking it one notch too far, people. And the Yeti's magical powers are dumb. He like groans or hums or whatever the heck he's doing. And it mostly makes plants grow. A magical baby Yeti and all this kind of stuff. My biggest problem, though, with this film is that little heroine. What's her issue? Her father has passed away. She's lost her dad. But, you know, this is an issue for her mother and her grandmother. She's extremely aloof with them. And she's kind of like a pain in the butt.
She's hardworking.
Yeah,
she has like 5 part-time jobs.
She doesn't even know what her problem actually is. It is just an amalgamation of all of these things. They jam this magical Yeti in there. And then they have this magical Yeti just do all kinds of silly things that make no sense whatsoever. He can just do anything, this magical Yeti. I'm like, oh, now you're just making stuff up. And I know it's animation, it's cartoon. We're meant to make stuff up. But you're making stuff up while you're making stuff up.
The Yetis that you've known could not make the Earth.
There's no such thing as a magical Yeti.
Abominable, the animated feature this week. Jill Gulton, the writer-director from DreamWorks Animation. It's rated PG in wide release. The Laundromat is getting a one-week theatrical run before streaming on Netflix. It stars Meryl Streep, Gary Oldman, Antonio Banderas, and Justin Chang tells us.
The Laundromat shows, I think, that Steven Soderbergh is one of the more experimental filmmakers working in the American commercial mainstream. I mean, this has always been true of his work. It's a really fascinating movie that is perplexing and sometimes irritating and uneven to watch, but I really liked the way it came together in the end. This is his movie based on Jake Bernstein's 2017 book, Secrecy World, about the Panama Papers scandal. And so Soderbergh is launching us into the intricate workings of offshore bank accounts and shell companies and other means by which the global financial elite hide their wealth and avoid their taxes. And he has tackled this very, you know, heady, potentially dry material, which is all about corruption and greed and financial malfeasance, through a series of stories. This is a very playful movie, and it's about deception, and it's kind of deceptive itself in its structure. It starts off with Antonio Banderas and Gary Oldman as these men in tuxedos who are sort of loftily explaining how money works and how credit works. And they take us sort of through the whole history of money from the barter system on. And they lead us into, you know, this world of corruption that they are going to explore. Meryl Streep plays a widow named Ellen, whose husband dies along with 19 other people in a boating accident. And it's discovered that the boating company had been sold a false liability insurance claim. And so none of the families were going to get any insurance money at all. And so this scam begets another scam, begets another scam, and the movie kind of tumbles down this rabbit hole and opens into different stories. This movie has a very starry cast with, you know, Gary Oldman and Antonio Banderas, although their banter is not as funny as I would like it to be and as I think the movie thinks it is. They are sort of doing like the decaf version of what The Big Short did, which is let's educate you about these various, you know, issues that the average layperson probably does not know too much about. And I actually like this movie better than The Big Short overall, though. I think it, which I know may surprise some people because that movie was very popular. I think it actually comes off as more droll and less smug. It's still plenty smug, but it's not as smug. And the interesting thing about this cast, though, is that everyone is so isolated. The stories are very disconnected. They're discreet. They don't dovetail in the same way that, for example, the stories did in Traffic, Steven Soderbergh's great 2000 film about the drug war. These people are so isolated from each other, and that illustrates something about the way that capitalism works. You know, it's funny. Capitalism and its discontents are sort of Soderbergh's theme of late, you know, whether he's making The Informant or whether he's making The Girlfriend Experience. You know, how people respond to poverty, how people respond to greed is sort of his great overriding subject, even in the Ocean's 11 movies. So it throws you off balance throughout. I've seen it 3 times now, and it's weirdly rewatchable. It irritates me a little bit each time, but every time it's sort of also the way it comes together. I think he's made a really fascinating movie that matches in formal and stylistic terms. It gets at a lot of the complexities of its subject.
Justin Chang of the LA Times reviewing The Laundromat, starring Meryl Streep, Steven Soderbergh directing, Scott Z. Burns wrote the screenplay. It's rated R at the Landmark in West LA, and it'll start streaming on Netflix in the middle of October. We have many more films to come up with our Film Week critics. Stay tuned. We'll be back in 1 minute on Film Week.
Start your Saturday with something that will grow your kiddos' brains and get their creative juices flowing. Join us at LAS for a morning of multilingual story times, interactive performances, art making, and lots of kid fun. Bring the whole fam and join us for a super fun Saturday at LAS in Pasadena on June 1st. Tickets at las.com/events. See you there.
It's Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle with Tim Cogshell, Charles Solomon, and Amy Nicholson. Our next movie is The Day Shall Come, a comedy that's British. Chris Morris is the director and co-screenwriter with Jesse Armstrong. Tim, what'd you think of The Day Shall Come?
Rather enjoyed this pointed, biting little satire. Chris Morris sort of returning to that. He made a film a few years ago called Four Lions, a farce, about these terrorists in the UK planning to do a terrorist attack, but they're so incompetent that they can't seem to get it together, and they end up fighting amongst themselves because their ideologies don't match. And it was a bit of a controversial film, people thinking that it might not be appropriate to make fun of something like that. But he did it anyway. In this film, he's poking mostly at the authorities, the FBI, planning these sting operations all around Miami, Florida. And there's this one delusional young black preacher who has all kinds of nutty ideas about things leading this church. He's not a terrorist in any way, shape, or form, refuses to use guns. But when they offer him money, he pretends to be a terrorist so that he can get the money to save his church. And this is all about how everything just goes completely and totally out of control. It's really, really sharp and funny in terms of dialogue. Anna Kendrick, particularly funny in this movie. And it takes to task just about everyone involved in these kind of things. And it's sort of a wag the dog sort of scenario.
I was going to say, because that film, in the complexity of its humor, sounds like this is not an easy film to pull off.
Exactly, because oxymorons all around.
What do you think, Amy?
Yeah, I mean, this is a perfect role for Anna Kendrick, you know, to play an FBI agent who is hyper-focused, overcommitted, and winds up realizing slowly that she might be putting all of her powers to being on the wrong side. And I just enjoyed this so much. You know, it is hard to laugh at, especially as the jokes get more and more true and it transitions from kind of a slapsticky humor to like that bitter bark. Oh, yeah, yeah, that is how the world might work. And I don't want to think about that kind of humor. It gets painful. But I really did love this debut performance by Marchant Davis, too, who a person who you see in the way he carries himself and the way he's wearing a shower curtain as a cape. You know, this
But selling it completely.
This, because he's not wrong about everything. He's against gentrification. That's really the important thing to him. And you want to believe him and you want to be part of his army in a little bit of a way. You're like, I get your army. And then you watch the army go through exercise routines that are a bunch of goofy squats and cartwheeling.
Yeah.
It's a good mix. It's a really good mix. It's good to see Chris Morris back, and we need a Chris Morris right now.
The Day Shall Come is the comedy. It's at the Arclight Hollywood, Arclight Sherman Oaks, and downtown LA at the Alamo Drafthouse. It's unrated. Loro, an Italian biographical drama that looks at Silvio Berlusconi. Paolo Sorrentino is the director and co-screenwriter. Amy?
Yeah, I mean, Silvio Berlusconi, for anybody who needs a recap, he was a populist politician elected to office in Italy, a man who had $8 billion made in questionable real estate deals, then went into TV, then had a lot of sex scandals. So there's a lot of, parallels that the distribution company is hoping we'll see here in America. And this film has so much style. You know, it's divided most into two halves in a way, where the first half you're watching a wannabe hustler who wants to get in with Berlusconi assemble an army of girls and rent a mansion next to Berlusconi's house to try to get his attention and lure him over for a party in order to make his bones in Italy, figure out a way to earn a bunch of money, you know, his auditions and seeing what the girls can do. You know, it's a lot about seeing women as currency through these men who are just wannabes and losers. And then the second half, it focuses more on Berlusconi, more on his wife, who I think has a really strong role in here. And you watch his gradual collapse. And it's in the second act that I was like, oh, these are the things that, you know, people are always fighting over in a Scorsese movie. You know, is a movie like Wolf of Wall Street glamorizing it or is it not? This movie is so confident and so intelligently done that you know exactly what side it's on. Even as you're watching Berlusconi at a party where women are in Halloween costumes stripping for him, this film really gets across also the emptiness and the cheapness of it. You know, it doesn't feel just like glamour. And I was really actually impressed by just like the powerful, really beautiful direction. There's like a lot of gorgeous imagery in here, a lot of things about butterflies because he loved to give women necklaces with butterflies on them. I mean, I was really knocked out by this, to be honest.
Loro is the film, Tim.
Powell's films are full of beauty and decadence. Great beauty. This Must Be the Place, youth. These are the things that he populates his films with, and very much in the same way that Fellini used to, films like Satyricon or something like that. In this particular instance, the decadence owes to this actual man who was actually decadent, Berlusconi. And he's speaking to that. His wife, Veronica Lara, was famous. And she's tired in this movie. This is around the middle 2000s, when just before everything sort of came apart for him. And he's trying to lure her back home, but she's tired of all of the affairs. She's tired of being humiliated. And she's, you know, she's challenging him about all of that. And he is trying to turn on that Berlusconi charm to see if he can get it all back again. And he's doing it with everything in his life. He's, if he can just hit that switch one more time.
Although the joke's on us, he's back in office.
Yeah, the joke's on us indeed.
Loro, the biographical drama on Silvio Berlusconi. Paolo Sorrentino, the director and co-screenwriter. Unrated, it's at Lemley's Royal in West L.A. and on video on demand. The comedic drama The Death of Dick Long stars Michael Abbott Jr. and Andre Hyland. Daniel Scheinert is the director and Billy Chu, the screenwriter. Amy?
Yeah, this is a film by this group called The Daniels, and I've been really looking forward to seeing what their follow-up feature is going to be to their earlier film, Swiss Army Man, which people might know as the movie in which Harry Potter plays a corpse who farts a lot. I don't know how to say it on air. I'm sorry, but that's what it's about.
It's all right.
It's a buddy comedy between a man and a dead man. And this one is also just strange and surreal in a very, very, very different way. What The Death of Dick Long is about is it opens with three buddies who are in a nu metal garage band playing in their basement. You know, this is a song that very seriously has an earnest Nickelback score, or ironically, earnestly has a Nickelback score. It's very hard to tell with The Daniels. And one of them turns to the other and says, "Wanna get weird?" Cut to two of the men taking a third one off and dropping him off at the hospital and that man dying. And so a lot of the suspense in this movie is, what did they do? And once you answer that question, it becomes, actually really lovely film about what do you do when you have done something unforgivable and how do you explain it to people and what if you can't and what if it's something that just sounds so gross when you say it out loud, because this is of course The Daniel, so it's got to be a little gross, you know, what do you do when you've hit that point? And it has kind of a lovely message about being unforgiven at the end. And so I was struck again, as I was in Swiss Army Man, that you watch something that seems a little bit scatological, a little bit goofy, not meant to be taken sincerely at all, build its way up into something that actually has a lot of emotional resonance. I find these directors, the Daniels, endlessly surprising. And I'm very curious. They're young. I'm very curious where they're going to go.
The film is The Death of Dick Long. It's rated R. It's at the Arclight Theaters and at the Alamo Drafthouse, downtown L.A. Aga is a drama that's directed by Milko Lazarov and also co-wrote the screenplay of the film. Tim, is this a Bulgarian movie?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, Bulgarian movie, but although it's set near the Arctic, up in the north, it's absolutely strikingly beautiful. Vistas of snow and ice and this old Inuit couple. Living in much the way the Inuits have lived for many, many years, drilling holes into the ice to catch fish and all this kind of stuff. But everything is not working anymore. It's warmer than it's supposed to be. The animals aren't coming down. It's all about global warming and what is happening. It's funny because he notices this and she keeps dismissing it. Oh, it's always been this way. So the little internal argument that we have as a nation, as a world, is the argument that they're having in their family. Funny, this film, his name is Nanook in this film. This film was once called Nanook, reminiscent of Nanook of the North. 1922 silent film, Robert J. Flattery, in which that's a documentary where he's simply watching this family, you know, Nanook, as they lived 100 years ago. That's exactly what's going on in this movie. Only this is a narrative film, and we see the encroaching of civilization on their lives as his wife gets sick and suddenly the earth moving equipment is coming and the hunting is it's a very, very striking film.
Aga?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of this film. I caught it a while ago in the festival circuit, and we gave it a prize because we're really struck by it. It has gorgeous cinematography, really bold and striking shots. We're just taking in the sky, looking up at a skinned rabbit, you know, and like Nanook of the North, which is the original one, a documentary that's kind of quote-unquote documentary. You know, this has the feel of a documentary, but you know that a lot of it is made up. I don't think the people from this region actually fish the way they fish here. But you believe it. It's very credible. And it is fascinating to watch the changes in our planet today from people very much on the outskirts, not following the news, and to see what happens when they have to leave their home a little bit and what the world likes around them. Like, you just have such a sense of place here. It's a really striking film.
Aga, the movie, it's at Lemley's Royal in West L.A. and Lemley's Playhouse, Pasadena. It's unrated. Always in Season, a documentary that's directed by Jacqueline Olive. Tim?
Jacqueline Olive, a participant in a number of American Independent Lens films, documentaries. So she comes by her chops legitimately, having worked on so many of those films. This is a deeply difficult film, very moving. A young man named Lennon Lacey is found hanging from a swing set. The police immediately decide that it was suicide. His mother and all of the black folks in this community, Bladensboro, North Carolina, know that that is completely and totally ridiculous and that he was lynched. This town, this place, has a deep history going back through the lineage of lynching, including a particular lynching in 1934 that sort of shadows what seems to have possibly happened to this young man.
When did this take place?
2014 is when the young man was found. They contextualized the story by putting it within the context of the history of lynching across the South. Lots of images in this film that are difficult to watch, young men hanging from trees, with white folks all gathered around looking into the camera's lens. In the middle of the last century is when these things were there. That context is everything for this movie and how the investigation plays out.
Yeah, I'm with Tim. It is just moving and sad and horrifying that something like this could still happen in the 21st century. Although Danny Glover does the narration, the boy's mother and his brother are articulate and eloquent, and they just have your heart in their hands. It's, I think, an important film, but not an easy one to sit through by any means.
Always in Season, the documentary. Jacqueline Olive, the director, it's unrated at Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. The documentary Don't Be Nice is directed by Max Powers. Tim?
Yeah. So we watch as five members of the Bowery Poetry Slam team are chosen to go off to the Nationals for a big poetry contest. The poetry is quite interesting. This is the thing about poetry slams. I don't understand why there's competition in poetry. Poetry competition just simply doesn't make any sense to me. Poetry is wonderful. Why are we competing? But that's what goes on here. And look, the film notes that folks who win these slams, they can get book deals, easier to get teaching jobs, stuff like that. So there's a value that comes out of winning these things. But poetry and competition, no.
All right. It's Don't Be Nice. The director, Max Powers, It's Unrated, Lemley's Glendale, and The Game Changers. Charles, about a UFC fighter, this documentary?
Well, this is not so much a documentary as a recruiting poster for veganism. And it deals in a lot of partial facts and incomplete facts. And yes, we don't have the shearing teeth and short gut of a true carnivore like our cats. But we also don't have the big molars and an intestinal system that can digest cellulose. So we aren't necessarily programmed to be vegetarians. I'm sure it means well. We eat too much meat for our good and the planet's good. But it's selling you a bill of goods.
The Game Changers, the documentary. Luis Cejuelos is the director. It's unrated at the Vintage Los Feliz Theaters. Coming up, we'll hear about the documentary Jim Allison Breakthrough, also about the Canadian documentary Anthropocene, the Human Epoch. That all comes up on Film Week here on 89.3 KPCC. And we'll also remember Sid Haig, who had a very long career character actor, particularly later in his career in Rob Zombie's horror films. We'll talk about his influence. We'll be back in a couple minutes.
As a farmer's son from a desert region in California, J.B. Hamby thinks a lot about water.
I spent a lot of time digging up history, particularly about water, which is the origins of the Imperial Valley.
How this 28-year-old became the youngest lead negotiator on the Colorado River ever, and how he could shape the most consequential negotiations to date. Listen to Imperfect Paradise, the Gen Z water dealmaker, wherever you get podcasts.
Some really interesting movies this week. I always love when we have that on Film Week. Makes it a lot more fun. Our thanks to our critics who are joining us, Tim Cogshell, Amy Nicholson, and Charles Solomon. Our next film, the documentary Jim Allison Breakthrough. Amy, what'd you think?
Yeah, let me tell you who Jim Allison is. Yeah. He's a kid from rural Texas. He's buddies with Willie Nelson. He's a real goofball. He likes to drink beer. His mom died of cancer when he was 11. And Jim Allison has now devoted his life to figuring out how to cure cancer, which you're like, okay, sure, another Texas beer drinking crackpot. But no, he actually got the Nobel Prize last year because his theory is he was looking at T cells and the way they worked. And he thought, well, if T cells identify disease, what's happening when they meet a cancer cell? What's going wrong? And he deduces his way down to a thing called CTLA-4. And he says, if I mess with this, I wonder if I can get a T cell to actually attack cancer like it needs to. And he can. He actually can. And so the first half of this film is him coming up with the breakthrough, like a real trace of his life, going through it, all the trials, all the errors, all his lab partners. And then in the second half, when you're like, you're not a crazy crackpot, this is incredible, it becomes more of a documentary about big pharma and trying to get people to get the message out. And I think that is where it's a little more messagey.
It's interesting. These films about iconoclasts, very often when you have an iconoclast, they'll be out on the edges of things, and they'll be called fringe people, quacks, you know, global warming, all that kind of stuff. In any other context, that's what he would be, except that he was right. And that's the thing about these folks when they come up in society, you know, they have to be held in abeyance for a very, very long time until the thing that they say is true, they prove is true. And then everything changes. He's an interesting guy, plays the harmonica, hangs out. He also got involved in the Texas debate over evolution because the creationists wanted to come to Texas and start teaching creationism instead of evolution. And it's a fight that he had been having since he was in high school. He had this fight with his own high school teacher, who would not allow the teaching of evolution, which would, for him would have been like in the 50s
yeah.
or 60s, maybe the 60s.
Yeah.
His own high school biology teacher would not allow the teaching of evolution in his high school. Big fight. This fight continues for the next 40 years, right through eventually them doing away with the notion of teaching creationism in high school in Texas. He had a big hand to do with that.
The film is Jim Allison Breakthrough. It's rated PG-13. Bill Haney, the director. It's at a couple of the Lemley Theaters, Santa Monica and the Film Center there, and Playhouse in Pasadena. The Canadian documentary Anthropocene, The Human Epoch, is directed by, well, it's three directors, so I won't go into their names. But Charles, what'd you think?
Well, this is a very beautiful movie, but there's a difference between bombarding an audience with images and actually telling them something. They must have every drone in Canada out doing endless tracking shots of things, which they cut together not terribly effectively. And the idea behind the Anthropocene hypothesis is that we've changed the planet so much, there is no longer a natural world. Everywhere you go, there's pollution. It's affected by the rising climate. And they show things that people are doing that contribute to that, but not always very effectively. When they talk about the amount of nitrogen compounds and potash that have been dumped into the ecosystem in terms of fertilizer, they show you a potash mine, but it's photographed so beautifully with little sparkling crystals of mineral, it looks like it's going to be the centerfold in Fertilizer magazine that month.
They, which you're a subscriber.
Yes. The fold-out. Wow. you should have seen the salt mine last year. They also get off the track in some places. They go to a hydroponic farm in an old bomb shelter in London. Now, are we to conclude this is harming the planet when it seems to be using less water and chemicals? Didn't do it for me.
They go to some places and they show us the equipment, this human-scaled equipment, doing things like ripping entire mountains down. The biggest excavation machine built by man, biggest machine of any kind built by man in Germany, in this quarry. And it's just absolutely fascinating, this stuff. Reminiscent of Baraka, 1992 film, Ron Fricke film. Yeah. In that film, they juxtaposed the cultures that were being affected directly to the things that we were doing. Here, it just shows us the things that we were doing and impresses us with scale, but it doesn't really say this equals that.
The movie again is Anthropocene, The Human Epoch. It's for Friday listeners just tonight only at the Arrow Theater in Santa Monica. It's unrated. And finally, the biographical comedy Sister Amy, of course, Amy Semple McPherson with her Angelus Temple in Echo Park, was a huge radio evangelist and had quite the controversial personal life. Tim?
The film opens at Angelus Temple in 1926. Amy is doing
which
a
looks
healing.
Much the same. It looks
much, yeah. Much the same. She's doing a healing on live broadcast radio, trying to heal a woman in a wheelchair, and she fails. Not that she ever healed anybody of anything in the first place, but nevertheless, in the context of what we see, she fails. She's spent, Amy. She wants out. She wants out from under her momager, probably wants out from under a lot of the fakery. And she stages a drowning or a disappearance into the sea anyway. All kinds of wacky stories are told. One woman says she simply evaporated into the sea. Two people die in the search for Amy. One man just walks into the sea to follow her. Another a scuba diver trying to save him dies. Meanwhile, Amy is on this wacky road trip with her boyfriend across Mexico.
Was the engineer of her radio station.
Yes, exactly. And married. And a really bad writer, that guy. With this Mexican woman who's sort of mysterious and interesting and perhaps just a little bit dangerous. I rather enjoyed this film. It was sharp and funny. I really like where it goes at the end, because Amy comes back. We know this. Amy is bigger than ever after she comes back.
Yeah, she's a huge figure.
Yeah.
It's hard to overstate her cultural significance in Los Angeles in the 20s and 30s, particularly as radio in the 30s takes off. What do you think, Amy?
It's true. I mean, I'm fascinated by Amy Semple McPherson, and this film was probably my most anticipated movie at this year's Sundance, and so it kind of broke my heart that to me this movie is a bit of a letdown. I think it's almost impossible for any actress, no matter how good they are, to really capture what Sister Amy was doing, the power she had on people. And when you can't capture that, to me this film felt more just sort of sketch comedy, honestly. You know, watching a little bit of it, having them laugh at like the complete, don't take any of this seriously, we are not being serious about history here. It has this kind of razzle-dazzle, let's put on a show, cheap energy that I wanted to love and I never quite could.
Sister Amy is the film. It's at Lemley's Glendale Theater. It's written and directed by Samantha Buck and Marie Schlingman. The film is unrated. Well, Sid Haig, who very late in his career, had a decades-long career as a character actor, but late in his career, he became a real star among horror fans for his Captain Spaulding role from Rob Zombie's House of a Thousand Corpses and the follow-up films. Amy, let's just talk a little bit about Haig's legacy.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of beautiful when you have a moment like this for an actor who you feel like never got all the respect they totally deserved in life. At least everybody now can talk about him and the films that he made and really honor him in his moment. And I was thinking about him because, you know, he died this week. And this week was also the start of Beyond Fest, which is like the genre festival. And so it feels kind of like this week of mourning and celebration for somebody like Sid. Like, this is a good week to talk about him and his legacy. You know,
and apparently he'd go to these horror festivals and people would show him tattoos of the Captain Spaulding character. It's like, what? You're putting that on your arm?
Exactly. I mean, can you imagine having a life like he got to live, you know, and getting to be such a big part of people's fandom and love of the movies?
And of course, his career went back to blaxploitation films as well. Tim, your thoughts on Haig?
Yeah, Sid was in Foxy Brown, 1974. He was also in Jackie Brown, 1997. Yeah. Why? Because Quentin knows. Sid, I ran into Sid all the time, particularly at some of these horror fests that we're talking about. He was great. House of a Thousand Corpses interviewed him for that movie. Sid told me, look, I had bad skin, so I leaned into it. And he played bad guys and heavies for 300 movies. That's what I like.
300?
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. Sid,
that's
so, and television. Oh, Sid was in Rockford Files. In television, yeah, shows. Sid was in Rockford Files and all kinds of stuff going all the way back. So, but that's an interesting thing. He looked in the mirror, 6'5" he was. And he's like, you know, yeah, who is that guy going to play? And he played that guy.
And he passed away at the age of 80. He'd been in poor health for some time. Sid Haig, a bearded character actor.
Pasadena Playhouse guy.
That's right. And he was there at the same time like Dustin Hoffman.
Gene Hackman,
all those guys. That classic class of the great actors that came out of the Pasadena Playhouse when it was a school, as well as, of course, the historic theater there. We'll continue with the success of Downton Abbey and the tremendous love that the fans have shown in the opening week of that movie. We're going to talk about other adaptations of beloved television series to film. We'll hear what our critics think are their favorites. We'll be back in 1 minute on Film Week. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. You probably saw that Downton Abbey was a huge box office hit, and with an audience that you wouldn't think necessarily be out on opening weekend for a film like that. Well, they showed out. They wanted to see the feature adaptation of the TV series. We're going to ask our critics about their favorites. I want to start with you, Charles Solomon, with animated films. So I'll throw out the SpongeBob feature film. I thought were quite good. And the South Park films.
SpongeBob, you know, huge hit. You try and go somewhere there isn't a SpongeBob pinata in L.A. The Rugrats and the Wild Thornberries went to features. So did Pokemon. But I think the most successful one of all was Mobile Suit Gundam. When that came out in 1979, it bombed. It stopped early. 2 years later, they recut it into three features. And there were fistfights breaking out in hobby stores in Japan to get the toys. Since then, there have been more than 25 TV series, a dozen features. They've sold tens of millions of those Gundam robot toys. And currently in Tokyo, there is a life-size Gundam at Diver City. It's 65 feet tall, weighs 49 tons, and undergoes a mechanical transformation at periodic intervals. You know, we've also had My Hero Academia and Naruto and One Piece and all the big Japanese shows will go from TV to features.
Some didn't. Like Astro Boy, I was not.
I don't think that was ever a feature.
They did
a fairly recent one.
Yeah.
Where they didn't have the rights to the image.
Okay, so it wasn't a true.
Yeah, it wasn't very good.
That's
either.
Why I didn't like it. Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't Astro Boy.
Tim, what for you are some of the most successful adaptations, TV to movies?
The Mission Impossible series. which is just completely insane. But I didn't really care for that first Mission Impossible movie. But here we are.
That's the best one.
But here we are, what, three, four, five of these Mission Impossible films later?
Six.
A six? Oh, my goodness. So the Mission Impossible films and also the Star Trek films. I think we just had the anniversary of the 1979 of the original Star Trek film.
Also the Addams Family.
And the Addams Family. Three of those came out of that, which is really strange because the Beverly Hillbillies film in the middle 90s or something like that. No, not good at all.
I'm still actually, and I liked the Addams Family films okay. I'm still a bigger fan of the TV series
John Astin and Carolyn Jones were wonderful.
The chemistry was so good on that, and the deadpan humor of that series, I think, still holds up extremely well. Amy, your favorite adaptations to features?
Oh, I mean, if we don't mention 21 Jump Street, what are we doing here? I mean, to me, that's just such a perfect example of figuring out what worked about that show and then taking the goofy parts and just really rolling with it. You know, figuring out how to not just do a note-for-note adaptation, but something that's more like a cover song in its own key. I mean, it's so fun.
Were you a fan of the Baywatch feature as well?
Wow, how could you say that to me, Larry? All the years I've been coming on.
Well, but I think Amy touches on an important point, that the question is, if you are going to turn a TV series into a film, you have to find a way to open it up and have a reason for it to be on the big screen without losing the elements that you still love. Another anime example was the Cowboy Bebop feature, which did that exactly. Whereas when some of the things like Hey Arnold tried to do it, the threats get too big and you don't want, you know, your nerdy junior high school character standing between you and the end of the world.
Yeah. Tim, any others that you want to point out as among your favorites?
Well, let me point out the ones that I think really failed badly.
Okay.
Dragnet, The Little Rascals. There was this run of these movie adaptations, Car 54, in the early to middle 90s, and none
of them
were.
The Three Stooges.
Oh, it was just a mess of them for a while there. And I don't know what that was. It's as if they just missed exactly what Amy was talking about. Every
single
one.
They didn't get the central, like your 21 Jump Street example. They got what they could exploit out of that series.
Exactly. And now I'm worried about the one I'm going to bring up right now. I don't know how this is going to go over. Twin Peaks. I mean, to me, like, I'm happy to watch Twin Peaks Firewalk with me, you know, to see that adaptation. I know that it's absolute insanity, but I mean, David Lynch is the master. I love that he was able to take the tone of what he does, take it from film to TV, and then take it back out, you know, that he just gets to do whatever he wants. I think that helped establish the template for just, we give in, whatever you feel like.
Yeah.
Want to point out that I think took the television series and really kind of faithfully gave you the sense of it, but longer form, was The Fugitive.
Yeah.
David Jantz, a very successful, very well-written series. At the time, I think it was the highest rated episode, the conclusion of that, the one-armed man is captured. And then Harrison Ford starring in the feature film version of that, which also was quite good.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't they also do a Man from U.N.C.L.E. feature?
Unfortunately, they did.
They did.
Yeah, because my little sister lived for that show when I was a kid.
Yeah, The Untouchables was, I thought, a very strong feature. Again,
The Muppets.
Not Coppola.
The Muppets have said.
That was De Palma, wasn't it?
De Palma.
Yeah, Brian De Palma, Kevin Costner. Yeah, so, okay, what are the elements that makes, and you kind of touched on this, Amy, for a successful adaptation?
I mean, for me, now that I'm thinking of something like The Muppets, it's figuring out your own also central story, you know, where it's not just an episode-long version of what you do, or a film version-long version of what you do, but The Muppets always figures out somewhere to go, something to do, and a way to really build in an arc. And what I've always admired also about the Muppet movies is that they build in the fact that the Muppets are often already famous. And so you get to see them as celebrities in their world. You know, it's like you get to follow them away from the TV show to have a different adventure. And so it doesn't feel like completely a break. Although also sometimes the Muppets are very capable of being like, now we're something totally different in a totally different place.
When it happens to be an ensemble cast where we're actually bringing the characters, the actors who were on the television show, like the Star Trek series, these are all the same people. That's the element. All of these people, as I knew them on that TV show, on this big screen, expressing themselves.
Bigger budget.
Being deeper and deeper, creating an even deeper mythology of the actual people who played them in the very first place. I think that's why those Star Trek films work for so long.
Yeah, that's a terrific point.
But when you make it bigger, doesn't the TV show then look smaller and cheaper?
Not necessarily.
No, which is weird. I don't think it does. Yeah.
Very often that, okay, they're working in more limited means, but this is what made you care about the characters in the first place.
Now, here's where I think it has a much tougher time taking sketches and blowing them up. We've seen a lot of the Saturday Night Live sketches, you know, turned into films, and that's a little more challenging.
Those ladies' man sketches that Tim, used to do, funniest things in the world. Did not work as a feature
Tim
film.
Meadows,
Tim Meadows, thank you.
Yeah.
Smalley. Same thing. Funniest sketches in the world. Feature film does not work.
We had a listener mention Police Squad, which short-lived television series. And then, of course, we had the Leslie Nielsen starring films that were very funny that came out of it. Yeah, real quickly.
I mean, if we're going to get into SNL, can I please say that MacGruber is the greatest thing that's ever existed
right
on the planet?
All right. And just want to mention again, you briefly touched on the Hollywood Horror Film Festival, Beyond Fest, which is underway. You have a favorite film or highlight?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, Beyond Fest is the best of all the tiny genre midnight movies that we've been seeing all year. There's a film called Vast of Night that I just reviewed out of Toronto. Kid from Oklahoma made it on a nothing budget. It's a period sci-fi film about an alien invasion in the 50s, and my gosh, it is an absolute knockout. But Beyond Fest runs till the 8th. It's got major things happening. You know, William Friedkin's coming to show director's cut of The Exorcist. Oliver Stone's going to be with The Natural Born Killers. And then just the best things you've been waiting to see, Parasite, Dolomite. It's incredible.
All right. And it's going to be at the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Beyond Fest, what we're talking about. For our Film Week critics, I'm Larry Mantle. Thanks so much for joining us on our every weekly presentation of Film Week. Have a great weekend.
Hi, I'm Tracy Thomas, host of One for the Books, and we are back for another round.
This is clearly an NPR audience.
Yeah, I think they're so smart. What the hell?
My guests this time are actor Vella Lavelle and author Amanda Montell, whose new book, The Age of Magical Overthinking, is out now. Join us on May 15th at the Crawford Family Forum for book talk, trivia, and hot takes. Tickets can be found at laist.com/events.